All right, welcome to class today. Before we get to the comments, I apologize for not having exam two scores in yet. I had expected to do that. I didn't want them to be fully auto-graded. I wanted to look at things before I released the scores. And I would have done that, except that my other class that I'm teaching sort of had multiple relatively minor, but nonetheless time-consuming catastrophes yesterday and this morning that have consumed all of my time. So at present, I'm not expecting to get a chance to go back and sort of do that run through probably realistically until tomorrow. I do hope to have scores out by Friday, unless the problems I'm currently dealing with last longer than I hope they will. So that is one thing to note. Apologies about that. I will still try to get those out soon. I'm curious about your feelings about lab yesterday. If you want to do the thumbs up, thumbs down in the in the participants list, or if you want to say anything, I'm curious if this was the sort of thing we should do more of, or not so much, if it was too hard, anything you'd like to tell me about it. So those people that want to emote are emoting positively. Most people are not emoting, so I guess positive-ish. Good to know. I should comment also, after conversation with my TAs, the next two labs probably won't actually be optimization per se. We talked a little bit some of the difficulties there, and so we will probably tweak those a little bit as we're moving forward. I also hope all of you have had a good experience submitting Fork yesterday. Reminder, we still do have another day of our late submission there if needed. My initial read was that most people either struggled with the API or got it to work, and there weren't a lot of sort of in-betweens for that. But we, of course, still have office hours and so forth you can use for additional aid. My TAs report the office hours have been relatively quiet, so if you want anything to talk over, I think you'll find them readily available. Of course, now having said that, maybe you'll all go out at once. Anyway. We do have another assignment coming up in a couple of weeks, and you have learned everything you need to begin on this, so let's just sort of briefly talk about this. So this is designed to have you use the various synchronization tools we talked about. Use pthreads on a reasonable thing. So we have supplied some skeleton code, which implements Conway's Game of Life. There's a nice description of it here on Wikipedia, including animations of how it works. It's one of the earliest cellular automata and has been studied more than you would expect based on some very simple rules. There's plenty to read there if you're curious. You don't actually have to understand it necessarily to do this assignment, but there's a README and an H file that you should read and see what they do. There's only one file you should be editing in the system. Okay, so you should be trying this out and see what goes on. We give quite a bit of material here, but the main thing you're having to do is take some code. We give you a correct serial single-threaded implementation, and your job is to make it faster using pthreading. For this task, you can't use the OpenMP we just dealt with because we're trying to make sure you understand the lower-level calls and how they work. Sorry about that. The timing of that is a little awkward, but we have various tips and so on that I would encourage reading. I really would encourage reading the README, reading life.h, all of it, reading the website as you begin to sort of get yourself oriented and see how fast you can get it. So there is that to discuss. We have some comments about there's the main function has various timing tests you can do and so forth. So you can get a feeling for how good you're doing at speeding it up with threads. So that is coming up. It'll be our last full-size assignment. We will have an assignment also due the last day of class that is more like a worksheet. And I actually don't remember if we have an old version, the current version, or no version of this live right now. I think no version. I don't want to check. Anyway, it is likely that if there is a version there, it will change. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. And that will depend on material we'll do over the next week. But the assignment on the 21st, you should be ready to go. So that's what's coming up. Yeah. All right. With that, of course, you're always welcome to pop a question if there's something else you want me to talk about. But my plan is to dive back into processors. Before I do this, let's just remind us about the introduction I gave at the beginning of the term. I talked about how there were six basic things we were going to talk about. Interrupts, how to safely communicate with hardware. Virtual memory, this illusion of isolation and multiple processes that provide. Networking, how to talk to other computers. Caching, how to avoid repetitive work. Synchronization, how concurrency requires coordination. We have done all five of those. Huzzah! And now we have processors. Let's remind ourselves of the overarching statement we said about processors. The main goal we have here is to avoid wasting time. And we're going to talk about why we might be wasting time here, but when we're thinking about processors, we're thinking almost exclusively about speed and efficiency. There's some efficiency that isn't speed. We can also talk about power efficiency and so on, and we'll discuss a little bit of that. So talk some of the things that computer engineers are doing to make processors more powerful and fast. And along the way, we'll realize they're very complicated, and we'll talk about some security exploits that have been created based on that complexity. And that will basically finish out the semester for us. I must not have done what I thought I did here. Where is the schedule? Here we are. So we will sort of go through a couple of weeks about how those things work, talk about a security exploit based on that, and then we'll be done. So let's remind ourselves what we know about processors. First, let's just remind ourselves of the processor we dealt with last semester. Hey, we created this little ISA. Okay, and you wrote some code in it, and you hopefully many of you have reclaimed some of those neurons and don't remember all about it. We're not going to have to dive into the ISA a great deal. But I do want to talk about some of the hardware that exists even for this toy ISA that's kind of idle. So, we've drawn various versions of this diagram over the past semester and a half. Where we have, let's sort of walk our way through it. We have a program counter, which is a register storing an address. We send that out to memory to get back an instruction. We split that instruction into different parts, most notably the I code, which tells us what instruction we're trying to do. That's going to be used to decide lots of other things. Exactly how many and what other parts we break it into depends a little on the I code. But there's lots of things we can do from there. Maybe we're going to the register file, reading two registers, adding them together, and adding to one of them. So maybe we're doing some sort of plus equal operation. Maybe we're adding an immediate to a register. So maybe we're reading one register value and grabbing the other thing from immediate, putting it through the ALU and putting it back in the register. Maybe we're taking a couple of registers to go out to memory. Maybe we're using some information to jump to an immediate value or to a value we have received from our ALU or from the register file, right? Lots of different possible sources we could have had coming in here. And so maybe we're just adding based on the size of the instruction. Maybe we're picking something else to decide where we go next. We have lots of different components for this basic ISA. And we would have more components if we were dealing with all of the complexities of an actual computer. It has other kinds of instructions. So lots of pieces. When we think about any particular instruction, though, first let's comment. We have all of this is sort of driven by one master clock, which goes into several different things. Okay, in particular, our two register files will have these clocks driving them. And so between two clock cycles, one instruction is running. And for any one instruction, I expect to use only a subset of this information. If we look at our instructions, I believe all of them use the register file, okay? But one of the things we'll notice is that many of them either use the ALU or use memory. Either the ALU or memory. There's a handful of them, basically instruction 6, instruction 6.1 and 2, which uses memory and ALU in some way, but has to use them sequentially. So we're going to have our clock cycle long enough to read from memory. This is actually the immediate value, so we could argue that happens in the instruction phase, and then run through our access. And so we've got, at any given moment in time, even in single instruction, if we might expect our memory or our ALU to be idle while it's waiting for the other one to get ready. The ALU can't start working until the register file finishes working, and many instructions are only going to use a subset of these components, which means that if we look at our operating processor, at any given moment in time, the chance the ALU is doing useful work for us is not particularly high. We have to be running an ALU instruction, and in the part of the clock cycle where the register files produced values and the ALU hasn't finished working, which is a smaller slice of that clock cycle than generally. And so at any given moment in time, we expect most of these components to be doing nothing useful. And the observation that doing nothing useful is wasteful motivates a lot of the various goals we're going to have in trying to make our processors more efficient. If we can get them all to be doing useful things all the time, we can be making more rapid progress on the tasks that the user wants our program, our computer to do. So we're going to talk about several different techniques that have been used to make this faster, to make it more efficient. And to start, the first one we're going to deal with is this idea of what we call pipelining. Pipelining outside of computing is more commonly known as an assembly line. The great innovation of early in the industrial age, okay? And one of the key ideas of an assembly line, let's just think about a physical assembly line. Let's suppose, I don't know, maybe I'm making go-karts. And so I need to nail together several boards. And for this, I need to have a hammer and some nails to nail together some boards. And I need to add on some wheels. And for this, maybe I need a screwdriver or whatever it is I think I actually need to make this task work. And if we work on one cart at a time, then we can't do these two activities at once. But the idea of an assembly line is we're essentially going to have, commonly a conveyor belt, though there's other ways of moving things around. We're going to have a station where boards come on, and at this station, people are using the hammer. And then we have these sort of box carriages of our go-kart having been put together. And at this stage, people are using the screwdriver. And afterwards, we have wheels put on our cart. And so at any given moment in time, I might have several carts in construction. In general, for every station I have another cart that is partway being completed. But there's various benefits. Not only do I get to save tool usage, so I just need one copy of the tool, but I can expect some specialization of the people that are using the tools. The person that uses hammers can get really good at using hammers. The person that puts on wheels can get really good at putting on wheels. And so they can do it more efficiently. Do the same task, fewer things they have to understand, fewer tools I need to use. And so the concept here is sort of we get more efficiency of tools, more efficiency of people, and that results in higher throughput. By throughput, I mean the things finished per week, let's say. The rate at which I finish things increases. The number of things I finish over a large period of time increases. However, I also get more latency. The total time from entering the system to exiting the system, if I'm only working on one thing at a time, that total time is merely the time to do all of the steps, right? So maybe it takes, I don't know, 2 minutes to do the nailing and 5 minutes to do the wheel assembly. Okay, maybe I have multiple people here to make that more efficient. We'll talk some more about that in a moment. Okay, but maybe I would say the total time necessary normally to make a cart is 7 minutes. That would be the latency for one cart. However, I also have some time on the conveyor belt. It takes some time to get things around. And so that extra delay of moving from place to place is going to make the total time from beginning to end of one cart go from 7 minutes to 8.5 minutes in this case. Okay, the latency is longer. So this is the time to finish one. I can finish more in a single period of time, but each one will take a little bit longer. And the reason each one will take a little bit longer is that some of that time is work adding in is sort of nobody is working on it. So I'm using my resources more efficiently, but I'm also delaying the total result. This is how it works with an assembly line. A pipeline does the same thing, but with our processor design. So let's look at how that works. Oh no, I didn't post my link. Let's see if I remember the link. I do. Okay, I'll add a link to this to the schedule afterwards. But let's start by looking at this picture. We talked a little bit in Koa 1 about the idea of fetch, decode, execute. So, idea we can organize our processor into different regions. And often when we're talking about pipeline, we talk about what's called the five stages. Okay, now, first, this is merely an organization of work. I am merely observing that for any instruction you might want to think about, if you do these five things in this order, you will always end up having done things correctly. Okay, so first, I'm going to take my PC and condition codes, and I'm going to use some logic to get the memory. In particular, the PC is what I care here, right? So I'm going to read the instruction from memory. If I do that first, I will never go wrong. If the second thing I do is go read from the register file, I will never go wrong. I never need to do something between fetching an instruction and reading from the register file. And then if after that, I now use the ALU, I will never go wrong. I never need to have done something else. I never need to have gone out to memory or like before the ALU is used in the traditional model. Okay, and then if after that I go to memory, well, maybe the ALU had to compute my address, so I may have needed the ALU before that. I probably used the register file to get either the source or the address or the value. But whatever I'm doing, all of that has already happened, so then I can go to memory. And then if after all of that is over, I go and write values back into the register file and then repeat. This order will always allow things to work correctly. And so this ordering, this idea of stages and names for them and so on, is useful for humans to understand and organize the work. Just like it is useful to think about assembling the frame separately from putting the wheels on your go-kart. But we can also make this into an assembly line, a pipeline. And the concept we're going to use here is we're going to insert more registers. These registers are going to act like the conveyor belt. So we're going to put an extra register between every stage of action. So, showing this picture now, we'll come back to it, but let's sort of think about what this means, and let's imagine a simple world. Okay, let's imagine I fetch and decode my instruction, then I have a register file, and then I execute memory and so forth. What does this mean for my code? Well, I'm going to have my PC. It is going to come in, go up to instruction memory, come out, go down to the register file, come out with some values. That is what this worker on my assembly line is doing. Not responsible for anything else. Not responsible for talking to the ALU. Not responsible for talking to the memory. It's just responsible for doing whatever work needs to be done and then putting information into this next register file, putting it on the conveyor belt ready for the next person to use it. And so one of the things we have to think about is what information could be needed later on. Well, I definitely might need the I code so that I know what instruction I'm going to do. I would expect the I code to be necessary. And any given activity I'm doing, executing memory and so on, it might need up to two values coming in and one destination. I might need to be able to add two things and find out where their value goes. I might be able to use an address and a value being written to memory, and so forth. But I'm going to have sort of one source, another source, and a destination. Okay, and this information will be all I will need in general to run any instruction I might care to run. Okay, so if I'm writing to memory, maybe the first source is the address and the second source is the value to write. If I'm reading from memory, maybe the first source is the address, the second source has no meaning, and the destination is where to put the value I got. If I'm adding two things, maybe this is one value to add, this is the other value to add, and then that's the place to put the result. Because there's different kinds of adding, I often also think about having what we call the IFUN, the instruction function, which is the am I adding or anding or oring or so on. We saw this, although we didn't name it that, even with our toy instruction. Right, in these separate little tables, B here is serving as the IFUN to further categorize what I'm doing beyond what the I code alone gives me. And so if I can make sure that this step gets the PC, does everything it needs to do, and puts the appropriate values into each of these things before the clock ticks, then they can finish with their half of the instruction and allow this second half to be done by this other piece of work, okay, this other step in my pipeline. And so then this other step is going to have an ALU and going to have memory, okay, and is also going to talk to the register file. It's going to talk to the register file. This is going to read from it. And this is going to write to it, okay? And so memory might go to the register file, the ALU might go to the register file, these sources might go to the ALU, they might go out to memory. I don't know exactly where they're going. The iCode and iPhone will tell me, but we can do all of the work and end up putting the answer in the register file. And the end result of this is that I sort of created this separation of work. Part of it can be done first, the second part can be done second. We'll come back to the weirdness of the PC and how jumps work here in a moment, but I can split up my work. What does this actually look like? Let's imagine we have some actual code. Let's suppose I'm add queuing RAX, RCX. And then I am going to, maybe I'm going to add another thing into this. So maybe I'm also going to add RBX into RCX to try to get the sum of three registers put together in RCX. You know what? To make this slightly easier to describe, I'm going to call this a subqueue instead. Just so they're easier to say the differences. So what happens? Oh, and let's go ahead and give these addresses. Let's say that's address 100, and let's say that's address 102. I don't know exactly how big these instructions are, but let's assume it's a 2-byte instruction. So I have these things going on. The first thing that's going to happen is I'm going to see my PC has address 100, which means 100 is going to go up to memory and come back down is going to be the add queue. And so the add queue is therefore going to send the RAX address and the RCX address into the register file. It's going to say the destination is RCX. It's going to put these values out here in the source. This is going to say I'm doing some sort of math, and this is going to say it's an add kind of math. And that's what's going to happen in the first cycle. So there's going to be a moment in time when this is what is going on. The add is beginning. We've just started to turn on our assembly line. This second stage is idle. It has nothing to do when I run my first instruction. There is nothing going on. If there's some earlier instructions, potentially those would be running as well. But the general concept is that it can just sit there and not necessarily need to do anything at all. It can just wait for the information to show up in the next clock cycle. So, I then have a tick of the clock. The clock signal has a rising edge. All of the registers freeze on their values and start emitting them. Okay. Oh, I did have one more thing I needed to do here. I needed to add one to the add two to the PC. So, what happens here is that all of these values get latched into their registers. Let me say a word more about idle that I meant to say earlier and forgot. What do I mean by idle? I mean the I code here is showing some sort of no-op, an instruction that does nothing, okay? Because I can't just, in general, I can't just selectively power off parts of my chip. If my chip has power, my chip has power. And so it, by saying it's idle, what I mean is it is running an instruction that does nothing and ignoring all of the other values because it's running an instruction that does nothing. And so out of this is coming the no instruction, no operation is happening. So both sides are working, but one of them is working doing nothing. You can imagine your assembly line, the person near the end of the line, and this line just starts up, still going through the motions, but just in the air. They're moving around and doing the work on nothing at all. When the clock ticks, okay, multiple things change here. But the first thing that happens is the value in all of the registers changes. Okay. So all of the things that were inputs become the actual values. So my iCode, iPhone, source one, source two, destination, these all grab the value that was being given to them, and it becomes what they now state they are doing. So this now says it is a math instruction, it is adding, it has whatever the numbers were that came in. Let's just arbitrarily say when we read from the register file, we got 34 and 56. And so this is now saying, ah, I've got a 34 and I've got a 56 and I'm going to RCX. Those values have been put into the register and are being emitted by the register file now. And this, having added, that has gone up to 102. So it is now putting out the address 102 is what's being emitted from this register because the clock has ticked. And because the clock has ticked and these wires have changed what they see, all of my logic now suddenly starts having new inputs, and so therefore it behaves accordingly. So this goes up to instruction memory, and we get down our sub queue instruction. We go down to the register file, and we grab the information that was there. I think we had said RBX and RCX, if memory serves. Be consistent about my coloring. Okay, and so it reads out some values and puts them in the source. It says this is going to RCX. It puts in math and subtraction here. It does its job. It's actually going to get the wrong value of RCX. We'll come back to that here in a moment. But it is going to do what it is being asked to do. And then this next stage, it now has values. It sees, ah, I am now doing math. That means that of the various pieces I have, it's the ALU that needs to come into play. And so that add is being put into the ALU. I've got that 34 and that 56 coming in, which means it's going to say 90 back out. Okay, and it knows where to send that. That 90 is going to be sent down to the register file, and the destination is going to be sent down to the register file. So the 90 can be put in towards the register file. And the memory, not doing anything in this state, this instruction doesn't access memory, so it can just sit idle. When I think about what's happening at this moment in time, between the last tick and this tick, I have over here the add queue running, and over here the subtraction running. Two instructions are both being worked on. Just in the assembly line, two go-karts might be assembled, okay, in different stages of assembly. And the farther you get towards the end of the pipeline, the closer to done that instruction is. So the newest instruction is near the beginning of the pipeline. The oldest, most assembled, most complete instruction is near the end. And by doing this, I can expect to see my ALU in the long run being used a larger percentage of the time. And indeed, I can actually make my clock cycle shorter. A clock cycle needs to be long enough for the longest instruction to finish work. In the, without a pipeline register, the longest instruction was going to be need to read from the register file, go to ALU or memory, and then go back to the register file, do all three of those things, and go to instruction memory as well, right? So I needed two memory accesses and two register file accesses in general. Now, I have one memory access and register file on one side, one memory access and register file on the other side, and so I can, in general, cut that clock cycle almost in half and insert a new instruction into my pipeline almost twice as often. Not quite twice as often because it takes a little while for these pipeline registers to stabilize, but almost twice as often, meaning I can get almost double the performance out of my system simply by pipelining it, by adding a couple an extra register between the two stages. Okay. A lot of information here. I'm going to go into some weird challenges and gotchas for this particular instruction here in a moment. Before I do that, thoughts, comments, questions, anything you would like me to say more about? Okay, let's talk about some problems. Let's go back and look at these instructions. My instructions have a dependency. The destination of one instruction is being used as the source in the next. Okay, we have a dependency. Dependencies make doing things at the same time not really plausible. Okay, if I need to wait for this first instruction to finish before I can begin the second instruction, I'm in some trouble. I can't do all of the work I wanted to do. And in general, if we take any assembly instruction or any code at all, we can think about the dependency graph, sometimes also called the data flow graph. This is a graph in the computing sense, as you've been learning about in DSA. Okay. The idea here is that if I take some code, let's look at some code. Oh, right, that's not going to be good code. Let's look at, I did not pull up the code I meant to pull up. No, why am I not finding the tab I thought I would have? Where, here we are. Okay, so if I go in and pull up some code, let's just grab some code you did yesterday. Okay. Let's go down to the base code here. Nope, not that one. All right. If we look at this code, we expect to have multiple things going on. In general, each step of the loop is going to compare, then it's going to increment, then compare. So I have a dependency between those. Let's try drawing out this dependency graph, right? I have I plus equals one. That needs to happen before I is less than n. So there's a dependency between those. It also needs to happen before getting S of I. And S of I has to happen before I can do the less than zero. Okay, so as I think about this, I do, right, increment, compare, read, compare. So I need to do that. And in theory, I could actually do some of this work out before I did that as well, right? So once I have S of I could also invoke log. And once log returns, I could divide by n. The thing that I have to wait to know if the if worked is only the things that are going to be visible when I'm done. So I have here, I have my plus equals. That has to wait for this to be done, and this to be done, and this to be done. Okay, so I have this dependency graph. Let me see if I can explain how I came up with this dependency graph. When I write my code, I write it in the rule that everything happens in order, but not everything has to happen in order. And the idea of a dependency graph is to try to draw something that only dictates those things that have to happen to get the right result. So if I don't increment before using I, then I'll either be reading from the wrong place in memory or comparing the wrong value. So there's a direct dependency on those. But if I think about this log, according to the way the code is written, this log should only be invoked if I is less than n and S of I is greater than zero. But I don't actually need to wait for that information, because I could compute the result of the log and then throw it away if it happened to not be useful. So I don't really need to know whether I was supposed to invoke log or not until this moment when I'm actually updating my answer, doing a thing that is sort of modifying the existing situation. And so I can try to come up with this graph that allows me to reorganize my code in various ways. And then any ordering of the instructions is consistent with this graph is, in general, okay to use. So one such ordering would be to do I plus equals 1. I is less than n. Then it would do S of I. And then it would do less than 0. And just sort of, greater than 0. Why did I write less than? Greater than 0. And do them in the order we would normally expect from how this works. Then do the log, then do the divide, then do the plus equals, right? This is the order suggested by C semantics. Is this what we mean by speculative execution? Well, you get to speculative execution probably on Friday. This is not speculative execution. This is called reordering, which we'll also talk about more in days to come. Okay, so, I guess running log before you know if you should or not is speculative execution. We'll try to define that more clearly in days to come, though. All right, so this is one order. This is sort of the C defined order. This is the defined semantics. But it's not the only legal order. And so I could, instead, I still have to do the thing that everything else depends on first. But I could do the plus equals 1. And then read from memory, and then decide to do the log, and then check to see if I'm greater than 0, and then divide, and then check to see if I was less than n, and then, and only then, do my plus equals. And this is a weird order to do things in. It's not the order we're used to thinking of, but because I do this last check before I do the memory, or I do both of my checks before I do my committing to memory, if either of them failed, I won't end up committing to memory. And so I can avoid having any visible side effects of what I'm doing, assuming the log function has no side effects, as I go through this and still have correct behavior. This means that my processor can analyze my code, Knowing what depends on other things is as simple as checking the source and destination operands. This can be done entirely automatically in hardware. There's not a whole lot of availability because we have a limited bank of registers. Just compare a few values inside of our instructions to find out what depends on other things. And if things don't depend on each other, then we can freely reorder them, right? In particular, as we think about this, we can sort of put my graph on this picture, right? We can think of this as having done a topological sort of my graph. I believe you've done topological sorts already in DSA. If you have not done topological sorts in DSA, let me know and I'll stop talking about them. But right, any topological sort of this graph is an okay serialization. And so I can take the instructions as given by the user in the way they appear inside the system. I can determine what edges they need to have inside of them. And then with that information about what the edges are, I can now do any arbitrary flipping of instructions as long as they leave me in a topological sort, right? So if I have instructions that don't depend on each other, like the log and the greater than zero, those instructions can freely be flipped. Or the I less than n and s of I also don't depend on each other, they can freely be flipped. So we can reorder the instructions in the processor if we want to. And we can figure out what depends on other things in the processor as well. This gives us a lot of potential power. Making hardware that can actually do this and do it intelligently is more complicated, but this actually is done in modern processors today. They do not execute the instructions in the order you provide them. They execute the instructions in whatever order they want, and just make sure you see the results in the order you expected. Okay. So this is the idea of a dependency graph, the idea of sort of checking what my dependencies are. And so if we come back here, what I need to know for a dependency between these instructions is I need to know, is the destination of this instruction used in either of the sources of that? If so, I have a data dependency. Data produced here needs to go there. Okay. And so when I have a data dependency, I'm going to sort of, my naive pipelining is going to get the wrong value. If we think about actual numbers here, let's suppose RBX was 20. RCX, okay, let's remind ourselves what we were saying here. We said that originally RAX was 34, RCX was 56, and RBX was 20. So we're expecting to add 20 to 90. The sum of 34 and 56. But at this moment in the pipeline, we don't see a 90 here, we see a 56 here. And so if all we do is sort of naively pipeline, just put things in different stages and push them all through, then in the next cycle, when the sub queue is being used over here and put in the register file, instead of putting 90 minus 20, or 70 in my value, I'm going to end up putting 56 minus 20, or 36 instead. I'll get to the wrong answer. And so there's these extra challenges to even doing pipelining, as well as more complicated ways of trying to make things run in parallel. We're going to need to deal with when we have dependencies. Before we talk about how to resolve those, quite a bit of information here. Thoughts, comments, questions about any of it? Can pipelining make things slower? If you had something a lot of data dependencies, it's like summing every register into RCX. Yes. Absolutely, right? If my dependencies mean that I can't actually do things in parallel, then having to move things from register to register to register will slow things down. Now, it turns out that simply adding isn't enough for that. Conditional jumps are the really troubling one because I don't even know which instruction to fetch until I know how the conditions result. But yes, absolutely, pipelining can make things slower if we have a lot of dependencies. Other questions? We'll see why conditional jumps are worse as we talk about how we resolve dependencies. Before I get there, though, anything else? Okay. I find I have a dependency. I want to react. I've got three basic approaches I can use. I can wait. I can say, I depend on something that isn't done. I'm going to wait for it to be done. I can forward, or I can guess. I'll get back to forwarding here in a moment. But guessing is a peculiar one. I can say, I think the number is going to be 56, but I'm also going to tell you where to check. So I could put in my register file my guess and what to check to see if I got it correct. So I could say, hey, I think, if we come back to our previous example here, I think it's going to be a 56. But when you come along, would you check the register file and see if I got that right? And so this, if I can get my guesses good, this can save me time. If I get my guesses wrong, I had the extra overhead of checking my guesses, and I'm going to have to undo things. Okay? So if I have a guess, I have the possibility to undo as well if I get it wrong. The other thing I can do is I can say forwarding. What this means is essentially I say, I don't know the value, but trust me, it will be in spot X when it's needed. Okay, so this is going to be a fairly complicated idea of how we get it there, but the idea is that instead of putting a value somewhere, I put the information about where the value will be by the time you need it. And so these are the three main approaches I have available for dependency. I can wait, I can tell you where it will be when you need it, or I can guess and ask you to check and undo if I got my guess wrong. By far the simplest of these is waiting. Okay. And in general, what I want to do when I wait is I mean just don't put values into registers. So if we wanted to wait in this case, I have a data dependency. This instruction depends on this instruction. It didn't know that before it went out to instruction memory and got the instruction. So it was in the middle of this cycle that this spot realized it depended on this spot. Somewhere in the middle of all of this work, it realized it depended. And so what it needs to do is not move forward with the work. Effectively, what it's going to do is it's going to have a big mux here. It's going to take all of those values. Arguably, for each of those values, it's going to have a mux. It is either going to take, I guess the I code is actually the only one we need to do, either the real I code or the NOP I code will go into the I code, depending on if we need to wait. Okay, so I can say, hey, I need to wait. Therefore, I'm going to tell the next instruction, I don't have work for you yet. I'm going to put a no-op into my pipeline. I am also going to have, essentially, I'm going to also tell this to not update. This can be as simple as turning off the clock, so that tends to have some other weirdnesses, but I can have sort of, maybe I'm putting the new PC in here, but if I needed to wait, I'm going to put the old PC back into the register. So the next clock cycle, I will get the same instruction again. Exactly how to make all of this work and some other challenges with pipelines are things we will talk about on Friday. I will see you all on Friday.